have Owen introduce Michael Alexander, who is a postdoc working with me at Lehigh, and he's going to tell us about gamma ray observations, Fermi and Agili observations.
Yeah, that should be fine.
Which one?
The top. The top one will be fine. So my name is, as Jenny said, my name is Michael Alexander. I've been her postdoc for about a year, working mostly with gamma ray observations of gamma ray binaries. I won't give too much of a background because Astrid gave a really nice, thorough introduction and background, but I'll just show a couple of slides. There are two main physical systems, the microquasar and then the binary pulsar. And both of these can have X-ray and gamma ray emission. So for the microquasar, there's a compact object, either a black hole or a neutron star, stealing matter from a companion via accretion disk, and then occasionally launching relativistic jets. So most of your high energy emission is going to come either from the jet or perhaps some thermal emission from the accretion disk in the X-rays. And so for the binary pulsar, as Astrid was saying, the BE star, or just the massive star, will have a strong stellar wind that will collide with the pulsar wind and then form a shock. And then if the pulsar wind is stronger than the BE star wind in this scenario, the shock will bend around the BE star. And if the BE star wind is stronger than the pulsar wind, it will bend the other way. So a good example of a microquasar is Cygnus X1. This is one of the brighter X-ray sources in the night sky, and it's been known for a very long time. A good example of a binary pulsar is this B1259. And this is actually the only gamma ray binary where it's known what the compact companion actually is. In all the other systems, there's still some debate. So this is a typical SED of pulsar 1259. So as Astrid showed, the same plot, actually. So there's emission over huge orders of magnitude from radio all the way through gamma rays. The optical emission from the star would be sort of about there. And in this plot, there's contributions from a few different sources that has been modeled. These lines here, that's synchrotron emission. That makes up most of the emission from this source. These dotted lines, that's the inverse Compton emission. And then down here, that's some free Bremsstrahlung emission. X-rays, gamma rays, and then the high-energy TEV photons, which, again, are the only high-energy photons we can actually detect from the ground through these Cherenkov telescope arrays. So in late 2010, there was a gamma ray flare, this AGL-2241. It was detected for 2 days by the Agili satellite, and subsequently, it was found to be coincident with a BE star, HD215-227, or also MWC656 is another designation. And this source was found to be binary only after the gamma ray emission. Before then, nobody had ever thought to check. So after this gamma ray flare, Williams et al. got some light curves and actually found that it was in fact a binary, and perhaps a gamma ray binary. So earlier this year, there was a paper in Nature by Casares et al. Showing actually that there's two disks in this system. So here we have the iron 2 double peaked emission from the primary disk, from the BE star disk. And then there's this helium 2 line that they actually overlooked in a previous analysis. And this is actually from a disk around the secondary. And when they model it, and when they plot the radial velocity curves, they see this. Here is the variation in the iron 2 from the BE star, and the variation in the helium 2 from the companion. And when they get the orbital parameters, they find that this star has to have a mass in the 4 to 7 solar mass range. And a normal star that bright, you would see it in the optical, and they don't. And so the only thing it could possibly be is a black hole here. This group also had a later paper this year where they have XMM Newton X-ray observations. And those observations actually showed that there is some X-rays, but it's accreting very slowly, only 10 to the minus 8 of the Eddington luminosity. So we can compare this with SIGX-1, the known microquasar, and they look fairly similar, except for that Cygnus X1 is much more active. It's accreting much closer to the Eddington luminosity, so it's accreting quite fast. But both have only so far been detected as flares. There's no continuous source of gamma ray emission for these stars. So when we're looking for gamma ray emission, there's two satellites, So for this system, this is sort of an artist representation. There's the BE disk. And then, so that goes from decretion, presumably flows on to the accretion disk from around the black hole. And then the black hole then just accretes that material. So there's two satellites for gamma rays. There's the GLA, which stands for this. I'm not going to try to pronounce this here. But it stands for Light Imager of Gamma Ray Astrophysics. It was launched in 2007 by the Italian Space Agency. And sensitive in the 100 MeV to 50 GeV gamma ray range. And it has a field of view of 2.5 steradians. So the whole sky is 4 pi steradians. So this is approximately 20% of the entire sky it can cover at a time, at once. And so because of that, the source localization isn't terribly good. It's 6 to 20 arc minutes, depending on both the brightness of the source and its spectrum. And then there's Fermi. This was launched in 2008 by NASA. Sensitive over a little bit bigger range, from 20 MeV to 300 GeV. Again, very big field of view, 2.5 steradians. And the source localization of maybe a few arc minutes. So how do these gamma ray detectors work? So you have up here, a photon comes in, and it interacts with a high Z material. In this case, for Fermi, it's tungsten. And then it hits the tungsten, interacts, creates an electron-positron pair. That pair is then tracked through these different layers. And then those tracks are able to be reconstructed to find the vertex of where the positron pair was created. And then that can be traced to a point in the sky. But then there's also an anti-coincidence detector above and a calorimeter below. Sorry, I couldn't find a good picture of all three of these together. So what the anti-coincidence detector does is it rejects cosmic rays and other high-energy particles that you don't want in your sample. So this essentially just detects anything with a charge and says, okay, you know, this is a high-energy proton, not a gamma ray, and then you can reject it. And then down here, when the electron-positron pair passes through, it gets deposited into the calorimeter, which then hits scintillators and photodiodes. Those photodiodes then read out the total energy of the photon. So you get the position by reconstructing the tracks, and you get the energy from the calorimeter just by measuring the amount of light that it produces. This is a 5-year map of the Fermi gamma ray sky. So here we have the galactic plane, which is a big source of diffuse gamma ray emission. And then lots of point sources. There's about 2,000, just over 2,000 gamma ray point sources at the moment in the 2-year catalog. The third generation catalog should be coming out soon. And then with an additional 2 or 3 years of data, there should be many more point sources. just point out a few of these. The Crab Nebula is down here. Supernova remnant W44. CTA1, that's a supernova remnant with a central pulsar. And then this is just a really bright gamma ray quasar. This is actually not an image that was taken, but this is actually a model of the diffuse gamma ray emission with all the point sources removed. So there's a lot of very looping extended structures. Some of these are caused by supernova remnants and other interactions with cosmic rays. So this flare was initially reported at 1.5 × 10⁻⁶ photons per centimeter squared per second at 5 sigma. And the initial report was just an astronomer's telegram, and it was never published, so we decided to go and actually, you know, reanalyze the source, and we found a similar value, which is excellent. But then we tried to look for it in Fermi. And Fermi does not see it with an upper limit of 10⁻⁷. So that's an order of magnitude lower. We're still not entirely sure what's causing this, but one possibility is just observing time. Fermi sweeps the sky and covers the whole sky for 30 minutes every 3 hours. And so during the flare, the Fermi good time intervals only amount for 36% of that. So if a GLAE happened to just be pointed at the source longer, then maybe that's the cause of this discrepancy. And just for scale, this flux, which is really bright in gamma rays, this is a lot of gamma rays, and that's only 34 per hour on the entire detector of Fermi. So this is a Fermi 6-year counts map. And so this is roughly 28 degrees on a side. And these are all the photons from this area for the last 6 years, roughly. So the GLAE flare was right down here. And that circle is about 1 degree across. And that's the Fermi, or that's the PSF. And the BE star is right where that little cross is. So a little off center, but well within the error box. So we take this counts map. We make a model of it using a maximum likelihood analysis. And we basically model, you know, and because the PSF is so large, you have to model, you know, does this photon here come from this star or from the galactic plane? And so you actually have to make models and use probabilities in order to get fluxes. So this is what the model map looks like. It's essentially, you know, what the sky would look like if you had an infinite amount of photons. And it would have this, you know, it'd be much, much smoother. We check our fit and make a residual map. Looks pretty good. Our source, which may or may not be there, is all subtracted. And then there's this guy, which is not a known Fermi source yet. And there's actually, right down at the center, there's a quasar that we believe has turned on just after the Fermi catalog was produced. So for the first year and a half of Fermi, there was no gamma ray emission, and then all of a sudden it shoots up, and then has stayed bright ever since. And so that's really interesting. But at the moment, we don't detect anything for the GLAE source. So we find a 6-year average flux upper limit of 10⁻. Compare that with LSI, which is a really bright gamma ray binary, and it's almost 4 orders of magnitude lower in flux or less, because that, again, is just an upper limit. So we also looked for modulated gamma ray emission, because it was suspected that this could be a gamma ray binary. So we binned it up over the orbital phase of 60 days. And again, upper limits just across the board. So, and this is 10⁻⁸. So there's no gamma ray emission that we can find at all from the source. So basically what we find is that, you know, a GLAE gamma ray flare may originate from this BE black hole binary, but there's no Fermi detections, and so it's probably not a gamma ray binary that Astrid was talking about. But it does have similarities to Cygnus X1, and so it is a high-mass X-ray binary, and may be a microquasar, but it's not a gamma-ray binary. And then, just a side note, you know, we detected a new Fermi source, so that's really cool, and it is probably a quasar. Thanks.
I mean, there is a real issue that this is a microquasar regularity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a big debate. You know, I got in the middle of this debate coming from the outside between the microquasar and pulsar wind models.
Yeah.
But the reality is they both have their advantages and disadvantages, and this needs to be sorted out.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that we've
Yeah, and so this is Fermi high energy, but then the very high energy gamma rays, it's also not seen there as well. So I think that's also pretty indicative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this proves that probably LS1539 is not like that, because it just looks different. Right.
I have air from SPA simulation.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Different disk orientations, and I found that if you assume a typical base density, it would be this the ablation rate is too high,
okay,
consistent with the recent X-ray emission, even if you assume the agar high inefficient rate.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to encourage optical observers to observe this system. To check
yes.
Whether the B disk has low density or not.
Yeah, and we haven't looked at the optical properties. We've just been focusing on the gamma rays so far. Mm. But that would be very good.